2009 when I decided it was time for a bit of a change from life as a lecturer in social sciences at the Open University. And about 2 months later, a light bulb went off in my head, and I looked around the faculty and said, where are the working class men? We have a very large number of women coming to study in this faculty. We have middle class men, but we have almost no working class men. And as the Open University, that's a constituency we should be serving. What are they interested in? Football. So I scratched my head, and it was pretty obvious after a few seconds thought that there was an economics, politics, geography and psychology of football. So I took this to the faculty and said, how about doing a taster course? Come in and do 6 weeks of the sociology of football. You like it, do the whole degree. Thank God they decided that they didn't want this and that it wasn't, didn't fit with the profile of the department. And I went away. And about a month later, I'm spending a very late night evening with my landlord in Paddington in central West London, which is pretty near where a lot of punk stuff happened back in the 1970s, which is kind of mine and his youth. So we're sitting there thinking, oh, the Clash had a squat down the road and this gig happened there. Why don't we make a map? Why don't we make a punk map of London? I go to bed at 3 o'clock in the morning. I wake up, the light bulb goes on again in the morning. And I think, football, atlas of punk, atlas of football. I then spend the next month drawing maps with my kids' colouring pencils. And this turns into a pitch for a book called The World Football Yearbook, which is a great big full colour in sort of reinvention of the World Football Encyclopedia. Some of you may have checked it. Lots of maps, lots of diagrams, cities with stadiums, where the fans live, and lots of numbers and lots of pictures. So I go off and I make this in secret. And I don't tell the faculty. And I take a year's study leave. And at the end of the study leave, I publish the book and I call the faculty and say, I love you, but I've got to go, guys. And I'm not working my notice either. So off I go into the great blue yonder. And suddenly realise, of course, that as a freelance, there's, you know, what am I doing? So I think, well, what have I been doing this last 10 years? And most of my kind of intellectual academic life was around globalisation and global history. I've just done the World Football Yearbook. And it just seemed obvious at that moment that I should have a go at writing a global history of football. Now, of course, there were two attempts to do so beforehand that I was familiar with. There was James Woolving's book, The People's Game, written right back in the 70s, which is basically his cobbled together notes from a history course he gave at York University, and wasn't a bad stab at it. But was, you know, he was just plucking at straws in those days. Bill Murray's book, The World Game, came along about 10, 15 years later and was, you know, an immeasurable improvement. But it was a book that was A, rather dry, I thought, in places. B had not kept up with the huge proliferation of football literature that had begun to emerge in more sort of serious academic journals and, of course, in, you know, popular writing. So I sat down and I wrote the structure of The Ball Is Round. Again, a sort of moment of epiphany, late night in a cottage somewhere in Wales, where I wrote down one list of the key moments that I could think of in football history. And then I wrote a list of the key moments in 20th century history as I sort of roughly remembered it. And there just seemed to be enough connection and enough literature out there that I thought it might be possible. So I wrote the structure of The Ball Is Round, which, to sell the book, I wrote the 20 chapters of the book, each at about half a page, as well as writing the introduction. And, you know, we took it to market. And thank God, a lot of publishers were very interested. And Penguin bought it in early 2003. And then I sat down for 3 years. I spent about a year doing a lot of traveling and a lot of reading. And, you know, something like The Ball Is Round is simply not possible to write without the kind of all the kind of, you know, literature that's out there that I shamelessly, you know, used as best I could. And I made an effort to travel to countries where there was interesting and serious football history, but at the time very little had been written or very little that I could find. So I spent some time in Greece and I spent time in Serbia. I went to the African Nations Cup in 2004 and ran with the press pack. And then in early 2004, I actually sat down and started writing, and I lifted my head up 2 years later, approximately, about 15 minutes before the 2006 World Cup kicked off. I proofread it during the World Cup, which I, you know, apart from one game, which I was lucky enough to go to, I spent entirely on the sofa. And then they gave me a day after the end of the World Cup to sort of finish it off. But it was there was no need. I didn't change a thing at that point. And the Ball Is Round went off to the presses at that point, minus about 60 pages at the last minute because the spine just wouldn't take it. So some of my lovely bits about China and lots of stuff about Australia and loads of stuff about Israel that should have been in there ended up on the cutting room floor. And then, bizarrely, though I think probably all of you will know this from doing a big project, I got very depressed, actually, for about 4 or 5 months because, my God, what was in my head? Absolutely nothing at this point. The Ball Is Round, just to say, you know, it's got a kind of, what can I say? I suppose it has a sort of deeper sort of intellectual background as well. Those of you who are kind of familiar with sociology will probably recognise some of it. I did my PhD in social theory and the environment and studied, 19th and 20th century contemporary social theory in a lot of detail. And the work of Jürgen Habermas and his relationship between system and life world and the idea of the colonization of the life world was a sort of very powerful intellectual tool for me working at the kind of most deep and hidden level of Ball Is Round, pitting the values, the dynamics, the meaning of play against the forces of power, money, and their systematization and bureaucratization, stuff that they come into contact with. The other thing about The Ball Is Round that, I tried to get away from some of the older models is I watched a lot of old football. Those of you who are familiar with world soccer, I think there's a few of you out there, should just take a look in the classified sometime, and you'll see Mr. Sammy Chung in Manchester selling a very large number of very illegally copied DVDs of famous matches and tournaments from the history of football. And I made contact with Sammy Chung and was examined rather fiercely on the phone. He asked me before we got to any business, is Pelé or Maradona better? And I said, and thank God it was the right answer. And I watched a lot of old film. I watched a lot of old football. And that was the basis of my slightly surreal, slightly off-the-wall match reports that sort of stud the book. The final thing to say is, in my heart of hearts, intellectually, I think I'm probably a comparative sociologist. And if that's what floats your boat, as football just delivers. Same games, same rules, same stuff everywhere, an extraordinary lens on the peculiarities of local and the specific. I sometimes wonder, with the sort of, the innumerable comparisons and arguments and theories that I kind of come up with along the way, whether I don't end up contradicting myself. I'm not sure there's a complete theory of the explanation of football in it. And I welcome those who've delved further and seen sharper than I managed in the midst of writing The Ball Is Round. So thank you very much for having me. And it's over to you guys.
No, thank you very much for joining us. That was a great introduction to the book. Something that I wanted to sort of get on the table for everyone else to sort of talk about as we all go to our own fields of expertise is that obviously in a book so large, even though we've just read half of it, we're going all over the place. And I wanted to ask, obviously you're anticipating people in their own geographic areas of specialty, critiquing your work when you went deep into maybe Brazil. Did you engage with a particular scholar who was constantly calling you on your points, or was there a specific point in the first 450 pages that you might change now based on reception of the book, or that people have really called you on, or very controversial events that you've covered, or has there, there been any big point in those first 450 pages?
Well, there are lots of little points that I would change, and lots of sort of dates that are wrong and stuff like that. In terms of being in contact with scholars, I was in contact with scholars where I could find them. And certainly in the case of Brazil, there were a couple of guys. And Tim Vickery was a fantastically close reader of my work and saved me from innumerable errors. I would do a lot of things differently. I mean, I'd print the real bibliography if they would let me. I mean, one of the sort of great shames of such an insanely compressed timetable, you know, because it was like 500,000 words in sort of 20 months. Was that I just couldn't do the footnotes and the bibliography at a level that I was really happy with. I mean, A, because they just let me have space, and B, because I was just so up against the wall. So there's a whole load of stuff and a whole load of, you know, intellectual debts that need to be paid up with, you know, given the opportunity, you know, take another 40 pages on. So those are the sort of main areas. I mean, in terms of kind of the overall architecture of the book, or any of its sort of bigger sociological or theoretical claims, I mean, I'm yet to hear a criticism that really takes it apart. But I remain open-minded on the question.
We can pass on to the people participating online in just a minute. But I was wondering if anybody here had a quick question they wanted to ask me, Lansing, before we throw it out to the internet world.
Hi, David.
Hi.
Hi. My name is Ben. I've got a similar accent to you. I'm usually the only one in the room, so I'm glad to have another British person here. I'm a PhD student here at Michigan State University, and I'm writing my dissertation right now. So one of the things I wanted to ask you about was you said one of the things behind the book was that you were interested in looking at the history of work, the working classes. You know, you saw a lot of people around you, and you know, you thought working class history wasn't done well enough. I think is what you were saying in your introduction there.
Yeah.
And in the book, it seems like perhaps what you found out wasn't what you thought you had found out in terms of the influence of the working class, especially in the early years of football around the world. It seems to be a very middle class game, perhaps in Britain, essentially. So I just wondered if this was a case of your research kind of disproving what your initial thoughts were and how you went about writing about that, or maybe that's not correct at all, and you can.
Well, my reading of this question was I still think that if you want to know about the world's working classes, then football remains a superlative lens for looking at the social life of the working class. And, you know, until the working classes start playing football and start going to football, it's not a mass phenomenon.
Okay.
And that, you know, in the end, I think is what really, you know, why it's much more interesting. You know, the history of football in the end is loads more interesting than the history of hockey or volleyball. Which have their moments, but it's when you've got, you know, really, really large and significant numbers of people engaged with it culturally and playing it and watching it. So I would still hold to that. I wasn't entirely surprised by the significance of upper and middle class social groups in the shaping of football. I mean, you know, a very passing acquaintance with English football reveals that's the case. I think I was surprised, and I continue to be surprised, just by the extraordinary range of social groups, be they, you know, religious, ethnic, states, components of states, proto-nations, regions, ministries of social security, all of these sort of social formations having their kind of place in football history. And I think I was really, that, I suppose, if I was surprised by something, I was surprised, but also, you know, sort of obviously intellectually excited by that.
I think that's true in writing as well. I mean, I've been in Glasgow and the chapters on Glasgow and the origins of stuff, it felt like you were really kind of excited to write about it and kind of championing it.
Yeah, no, I was. I mean, God, I think if you're not excited, you can't write, you know, I'd never have managed. You know, you have to be, you have to be engaged. And it was, you know, I was constantly turning up new stuff. I mean, I think a lot of it had been, you know, 20 years in the making. I mean, I've been sort of reading around all of this stuff, you know, for a long time. And it was a sort of amazing opportunity. I just struck lucky that I found a way of kind of drawing on all the years of study and reading into one sort of volume.
Yeah, I mean, the chapter on Glasgow, I mean, I just read Franklin Foer's book, and, you know, the stuff that you say is so much, you know, the research you've done is so much more balanced than, you know, just talking to a bunch of Rangers fans like he did, for example, and it, I thought it was really good.
Sorry, I didn't, that was pretty garbled there. Sorry, man, I didn't get most of that.
I was basically saying that I thought it was better than some super good research I read on Glasgow, so it was just a compliment, basically, so.
Peter, do you want to start the questions on the internet?
Can I throw in a question?
Hi.
Anyone can hear me now?
Yeah, go for it.
Hello, Dave. This is Tim Vickery here. We've spoken since I had the huge pleasure of helping you a tiny bit with the momentous achievement, which is your book.
How lovely, lovely, lovely to hear from you. Really, really nice, man. I owe you a very big debt of thanks.
I think all of us who follow football owe you a debt of thanks, because the book is a magnificent achievement. And in any small way that I can, I'm always talking about it on the radio or mentioning it on blogs, because I think it's a magnificent achievement in that there's tons of detail, but the lines of analysis are so clear. And this for me is what really sets it out. And my first question is, surely you've got half an eye on events going on in Milan at the moment, and aren't you worried that the suspension of Van der Vaart might cost us greatly? But no, the real question is, how would you compare your book with Jonathan Wilson's one on the history of football tactics?
Well, Jonathan Wilson's book is great, and he kind of fleshes out a whole load of stuff that I only really touch upon. I mean, I think, you know, there's always a tension in writing about football in this way. You want to write about the game itself, and you want to write about the stuff that's going on around it, and you want to make the connections where they're plausible and they make sense between the two. And in the end, you know, football has its own sort of internal dynamic and history, as well as the one that connects it to the rest of the world. And to me, Jonathan's book is, does something that I don't think I have the sort of, the take on it and the skill to do, which is to take that tactical debate, a very much more detailed account of how the game has been played and thought about sort of within, and still set that in a wider context, but the balance is very much shifted in the other direction. And so you see, one sees, you know, I read it and saw a lot of stuff in you.
Tim's breaking up now.
Yeah, Tim, you're fading out.
Hi. Am I still? You still hearing me?
Still can hear you, but Tim is
you know,
gone.
Tim's essentially.
Tim is stuck. I might have to hang up on him.
Sorry, microphone problems solved now.
That sounded better.
We're catching you in loose spurts.
Well, can I jump in while
go for it.
While Tim's mic is getting fixed. It's Peter here.
Hi,
Peter. Hey, David. What wonderful stories about the making of the Ballers Round. By the way, I used it in my Global History of Football course here in South Africa in the first half of this year, and it worked really well on so many different levels, so kudos to you. But I was also amazed at how many of the South African and also quite a few American students knew so little about the political and economic history of the 20th century world in particular. I ended up having to spend a lot of time explaining some of the things that you were tying to and connecting to and analyzing so well. And I think as a result, your football book actually taught my students a lot of serious history. So, you know, it's not just about sport, the global game, but it was also a very, very nice way to open up these new vistas on world history for students who were not familiar with it before. The one question I had for you was about this sort of constant tension in football between empowerment and disempowerment, which runs right through, you know, pretty much your entire book. And I was wondering whether if you had focused more on kind of lower division football and perhaps the amateur game here and there, whether that would have influenced your take on how football empowers individuals and groups and classes and nations versus how it disempowers them at different times.
Unquestionably. I mean, a number of the reviews of the book pointed this out, and there's no doubt, not just lower division football, but football as a kind of participatory culture. It, you know, I didn't spend enough time on that. I mean, in my defence, I suppose I'd say on the one hand, I think there was and still is less literature available because, you know, I was relying on, you know, standing on the shoulders of others. And I think, you know, the wider literature is still focused on the upper end of the professional game and the upper end of football governance. So for somebody like me, there was less material. And, you know, I was writing a book that was bought by a commercial publisher. So both in terms of what I wanted, in terms of sort of readability, and in terms of what I had to deliver to these folks who put up the money, I had to get the, you know, I had to go for the big stories. I had to go for the well-known names. And, yeah, I think the book, you know, on the one hand, it's great to have brought all of that stuff together, but I think you're right. The book would have a different timber if it had spent more time on grassroots football as a participatory culture. No doubt about it. I'm not sure we'd have learned. Would the balance, I wonder, of empowerment and disempowerment be different? I wonder. I don't know if I'm sort of in a position to make that measurement. I think the other thing is that I got a bit carried away in the sort of writing of the book and at the time thinking about football by crowds. I mean, I think that's, you know, in a way it was like in the back of my head, it was like, that's the popular, you know, big public dimension of football that I'm dealing with. I'm dealing with crowds. And actually that's only part of the story. So yeah, I think if I really, really re-gutted it and did it again, that's somewhere one would definitely want to go.
Thank you.
Just on the order that people are appearing here on the Skype list, Laurent, did you have any comments or questions?
I just want to, again, chime in. And first of all, thank you for the book. It's such an amazing work and will be so essential. I'm going to be teaching it in a class again. And so kudos for it. And this is Laurent, by the way.
Hello, Laurent. I love your book.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. So it's there's so much in here. And I guess, you know, one of the things I just wanted to ask you was about, you know, I thought your match reports were really fascinating. And I've talked before with Galliano's book, of course. And I wanted to ask a question about, I thought it was a really elegant way of somehow dealing with the permanent problem, I think, in writing about football between you know, the kind of big historical analysis and the long, the sociology that you provide, and then, you know, wanting to communicate something of the moments, and the power that you really articulate so beautifully in the conclusion of the game as improvisation, as spontaneity, and so forth. But I just was just curious, like, if you said that those match reports came out of kind of watching the games, but they, you know, because they kind of punctuate the book, and, you know, if you just had reflections on, you know, why you put them where you did, or the fact of, did you feel like you wanted to do more of those, or just that experience of writing. I mean, I think we've all struggled with how do you write about this and try to capture these different aspects of it. So that's it's kind of a vague question, but just to what extent did writing those, you know, did you feel like it was vital to doing something? Because you're able to do things, especially like the Great War, the one about the World War I, which I found incredibly powerful. You know, if you have thoughts about why and how you did that, and give us insight into how that kind of worked its way into a book that in that respect departs to some extent from Walvin or especially Murray's book, you know, which is so deadpan in some ways, you know, or you know, it's all one tone. So, anyway, I don't know if you have thoughts about that.
No, I have. When I first wrote the sort of proposal for the book, I wrote two of them. So they were always, you know, they were always part of the plan. And I wrote the one about the Zidane goal, which was a complete out-of-body experience for me when I worked. And I wrote one of the earliest videos I got hold of was Hungary 6, England 3. And I knew, you know, of course that was a game that had to be, you know, if you were going to do that, of course you'd do Hungary 6, England 3. So right from the beginning, it was my intention to do it. I put off actually doing it in the end because I was so overwhelmed with the other writing, and it was actually only in about the last 3 months that I sort of made my final set of choices and started writing them. And partly there were some that you just sort of felt you just sort of had to do. You know, that I couldn't not. And obviously Hungary was one of those. And, you know, let me think. I mean, sometimes it was, you know, I watched a lot of stuff that I didn't use, and sometimes it would be just a sort of a moment that sort of captured or captivated. So the one I wrote about the 1958 World Cup final. I mean, when I heard the Swedes laughing at their own player when he fell over, I mean, audibly on this old film, it sort of blew me away. I just thought, what a moment. I think the other thing is that I wanted, you know, I loved the Galliano book, of course, and that was, you know, the first or second thing I read sort of on my long journey. And, you know, I loved it that here was someone who was prepared to write about football in a way that was completely different, actually, from anything I'd encountered. And certainly it didn't, you know, something that was prepared to be a bit wild and off the wall and flamboyant about it. And though it tends towards the bombastic sometimes, I just thought, you know, great, you know, you did it. But what I didn't want to do was do the same kind of, I suppose I wanted, the historian in me wanted a little bit more empiricism. There was too much just invented stuff. And that's fine, you know, he's a writer and that's allowed, and we know the game that he's playing. But I thought, I really want to watch some stuff, you know. What did this thing look like? That kind of empirical thing, I think, drove there. And sometimes, you know, just stuff went off in my head. Like, so there's the piece I wrote about Everton and Chelsea. And, you know, it was just in the midst of that. Went with my friend to see Everton. We got these tickets to Everton and Chelsea. And I sort of came away feeling so comfortable afterwards. But, you know, cathartically, just had to write it. And sometimes, you know, I was just experimenting and making it up as I went along. I mean, when I really wanted to do West Germany 3, Hungary 2, 1954 World Cup final. But, you know, I'd now by then watched, you know, the movie. And I didn't want to go down that line, but I loved its sort of magic, Teutonic magic realism. And I'll make it a play. You know, just stuff went off in the head. So it was slightly random, and I think I was always reaching. I didn't have to. I was a bit worried about them. I thought, couldn't quite decide whether they were, you know, they were good or they were complete shit. Have anything? Do you know what I mean? Compared to, you know, we all know what match reports are like, and respect right. is due to the people who can do match reports live, because I ran with the press pack and watched what they did, and I couldn't do that stuff where you file it on the final whistle and then you go to the mix zone and you rewrite it, and I couldn't do that. So, but I didn't. That's what I definitely didn't. So I'm not sure if that answers your question. But yeah, definitely to capture, yeah, like you say, it's about capturing moments of sort of intense, you know, all sorts of sort of emotions and strangenesses in the world that conventional academic prose, narrative history, or match reports, you know, as we know them, didn't do justice to. So it came out of that soup.
Yeah, because I think it's brilliant because in part, when I've taught before, I've always wanted to assign, you know, I've assigned Murray and Galliano or something and then try to put them in dialogue, whereas here you have kind of both aspects. And, also, because, when I teach, I always, you know, it's so important for us to watch the games again and again, I think.
Yeah,
And to remember, in part because it pushes back against some of the assumptions that we, you know, that the kind of pieties that get developed about certain styles or certain teams, you know, because of course the games are always much more complex than they become afterwards. And I don't know if have you read B.S. Johnson's book, The Unfortunates? Have you ever heard of this book?
Tell me more.
It's this very weird book that was recently reissued. It's actually in it's like 24 chapters that are unbound from one another in a box, and you can read them in any particular order.
Yeah.
But it's all constructed around, it's all constructed around a journalist who goes to a football match and does a match report. And then out of that comes, you know, all this other stuff. If you haven't read it, it might be interesting for you to look at, because just as a really much more extreme experiment in terms of how to capture all the things that go into the experience of a football match. But
sounds great. No, I can't believe
this kind of experimental. You know, I think he was a pretty underknown, I think in the 70s, you know, kind of experimental writer who died young. And then the only reason I knew about it is because it was reissued recently and published again, and there was a review about it in the Times. So
I will definitely look out for that. That sounds just my cup of tea.
So anyway, but thank you again. I'll leave the floor open for some other questions.
Stephen,
I have a quick question for David. This is Stephen Apostolov from Boston. I like your book. I'm going to actually put it for my course, The World Cup Soccer History and Politics. I'm going to substitute Murray's book with yours. I have a quick question looking at your chapter 6. In a future version, in a future edition, do you plan to talk more about the American Soccer League and the huge exodus of British professional players in the 20s towards America?
Yeah, I mean, let's hope there is another edition. I mean, the book is on trucking along just about. So I don't know whether there will be. If they do, I seem to remember quite a lot of the America stuff got cut. I mean, that, again, just going back to the sort of excitement thing, I was just, again, completely blown away to discover all the things that you've been talking about. And, you know, I had just absolutely no idea. I saw the United States and you as a consequence. It's a real problem, though, with the Baldies round. I mean, it's already, you know, like 10 million pages long. And it's really hard, you know, and I'm sort of this, you know, one's loath to remove anything. So I just don't know, Stephen, actually, what I would do given the opportunity. I mean, there are so many things in it that one could have gone on in, you know, loads more detail. I mean, did you feel that was a real limitation of that section, that it sort of undermined the sort of wider argument, or it was just something that you, you know, would like to have just seen more of?
I would like to see more of the American Soccer League and more about British players coming to play here for higher salaries.
Right. Right.
Personally, my research has to do with that. By the way, I made it to mention that I work. I'm about to finish my dissertation on the history of soccer in Massachusetts, and there were many things around the Northeast.
Great. I'd love to see it when you put it out there. Send it to me. I would be really interested to see what you've come up with. I mean, I would love to read more in that area about what the crowds were like. I mean, I found that, you know, I learned the sort of organizational history and the Andrei Markovits, which sort of sets it in context, and some of the other stuff around that. But what I never really got from any of that literature was the feel of what it was like to be at Bethlehem Steel at some time in the late 1920s, or any of those other clubs of that era. And that would be really exciting to get some sort of textured social history and accounts of that.
I'm trying to publish a paper, the findings of my dissertation, and when it gets improved by Soccer and Society, I'll send you a copy.
Okay.
I'm very grateful to Peter because he reviewed my paper.
Okay.
Andrew, thank you.
Would you like to ask something next, Andrew?
Sorry, did you say for Andrew?
Yep, go ahead.
Sure, that'd be great. So given the forum and given the incredible and impressive breadth of the book, I guess my question is where it left you in terms of an intellectual agenda for world football and for studying world football. And I also listened to the podcast from, I think it was the LSE podcast, where you mentioned feeling like the potential of football lay primarily in solidarity and in play as sort of forms of potential resistance against sort of global capitalist imperialism. I was really intrigued by that and wondering if that's sort of a conclusion that you have in terms of where kind of concerned scholars would be wise to take their work, or what your recommendations are given the breadth of your work for others of us who are trying to make some contributions.
Good, really interesting questions. I mean, where it left me, as I said initially, was very depressed. I felt very weird for about 5 months, and I ended up filling my head with baseball as a consequence to try and fill the gap. I discovered Jackie Robinson, and there I was. That sorted me out for 4 months, and then I sort of, at Christmas that year, we had an absolutely awful family argument, and suddenly the thought of watching the football highlights by myself in another room became intensely appealing. And I sort of returned to the world of football. In terms of where did it leave me with a sort of political and intellectual agenda? I mean, I think you're right to sort of pick out that I think, you know, as a symbolic demonstration and a practical experience of solidarity and the pleasures of play, you know, football in particular, but, you know, sport in general, but football, you know, for a number of reasons especially, is a sort of site of psychic and emotional and practical resistance. And I would like to think, and certainly, you know, the tide is slightly shifting in Europe on this, that in terms of agendas about assets and ownership and the public and the private sphere and what it is legitimate to be in the public sphere and what is legitimate to be in the private sphere, football clubs have dramatised that. The experience of football clubs have dramatised that hugely. You know, the idea that that a football club is really, you know, can be private property, when in actual fact all it really consists of is, you know, the collective and shared energies, emotions and historical narratives of the people who've invested in it. I mean, they're the people who create all the value that exists in these things. The idea that that can be privately owned is, you know, is just ethically beyond ludicrous. And even here in you know, in England, there is, you know, a certain move to think about alternative systems of ownership. And so that's, you know, there's that agenda as well. I mean, I think in certainly my more recent experiences in Africa, and particularly my experience in Kenya with the Mathari Youth Sports Association and Mathare United, their professional club, make me think that as a, you know, an instrument not just of solidarity, but, you know, active building of social and economic capital, of self-education and organisation, the potential of football there is absolutely huge. I mean, we've barely scratched the surface, but there's an extraordinary sort of, you know, role model to follow and to learn from in Kenya. So that I feel good about that. I think you know, the other thing that's got to come, the most central thing in a way on the political agenda of football, though, is its global governance. And, you know, the recent, you know, the World Cup bidding thing. I mean, I should think all of you just went, surprise, you know, because we know, my God, it's so out there. It's not true. You know, the rule of law does not pertain. You know, global football is run as about the most untransparent, undemocratic, unaccountable, you know, impenetrable, you know, set of patronage related cliques it is possible to imagine. And the idea that these guys and that institution, in perpetuity, untouchable, you know, who hold the global game, you know, in trust for the rest of us, this just can't go on. This is beyond absurd. And you know, and Blatter's, you know, trying to set up, you know, a fourth coronation. I mean, you know, term limits. There are so many things. I mean, you know, but finding a way of mobilising political support, you know, political support for a serious reform of FIFA. That actually, you know, you've got to start thinking about getting, you know, governments on board. You've got to start thinking about getting serious levels of support and organisation. Man, I don't know where to start. So that's the agenda. I mean, I just put that out to everybody. You know, that's what that's where I'm at. I mean, I'm going to make a documentary for Radio 4 next year on the history of FIFA. They're going to give me two parts, and that'll be my little provocation and stab at it. And I'll continue to write and whatever. But this requires collective action. So yeah, I don't know, guys. You tell me.
How about from Tom?
Yes, Tom from New Jersey here. First time caller, right?
Hi.
Hello. I've taught this book twice, once last fall in a seminar and once during the World Cup during a summer session. And what was great about the summer session is that we got outside the classroom into some of these social clubs, ethnic clubs, couple of the soccer islands that you talk about in your U.S. section, Kearney, New Jersey, Newark, New Jersey. And we were looking at this kind of issue of national character studies and how it gets discredited after World War II. But then, you know, right at the beginning of your book, you're quoting from Galeano, even, you know, right after the table of contents, you know, show me or tell me how you play and I will tell you who you are and who you are as a people. We visited this one sport club, Portuguese, and we asked that question to a local politician. And he says, well, the Portuguese are hardworking, conservative. And then he morphs into a discussion of the Brazilians. And Brazilians had been displacing the Portuguese in this section of Newark. And he goes and talks about them in stereotypes, lazy, not hardworking. And I couldn't believe it was coming out of a Portuguese-American politician's mouth. But what would you say, this construct of national character studies, discredited, but it's durable in a lot of ways. And the students picked up on this. Basically, how a team plays on the field is how they are as a people. Could you respond to that?
What I would say is, you know, there's a lot of myth-making going on in the world. But, you know, as with all forms of collective and social identity, I mean, I think that football and the way it's played and represented, you know, often serves as the raw material for these discourses and debates. And, you know, sometimes we collectively make good use of it and we end up telling interesting or provocative or different or enlightening stories about ourselves and our styles. And sometimes we end up telling really horrible, stupid, ugly stories, particularly about other people. And there is a sort of, you know, there's sort of partly a measure of sort of choice about that, you know, and about how good we are at sort of constructing these things. I mean, I don't see it. I think I take on board entirely that this is, you know, there's a constructive process going on here. And actually, you know, particularly, you know, in a globalized world, people play in the same, you know, pretty much the same way everywhere. I mean, you know, when the world was more separate, I think things were a little bit, you know, there were more sort of, you know, genuine differences, but everybody knows everybody now. But it remains, I mean, you know, what else in England, for example? You know, we have so few arenas of common culture in which we can collectively think about who we are and what we are. That, you know, that you can actually imagine something slightly beyond the sort of usual elites having that conversation. So I think it's pretty legitimate in England to have that conversation. It's a really crap conversation. I don't know whether that helps, Tommy.
Yeah, I mean, but in particular the World Cup, I mean, I had a commentator come to the class and he says the World Cup should have gotten a daytime Emmy because it was, you know, almost a script. The French implode, you know, the U.S. hardworking, England having internal issues. You know, so it was interesting. Even all these years later, these things can still be picked at and plucked at and used to explain to viewers, you know, across the globe.
Yeah, no, sure, but, you know, and then there were sort of, you know, completely counter, you know, ones that were completely counter to the standard stereotype. So, you know, it's goodbye to happy-go-lucky, naive Africans and welcome to, you know, mean, defensive, organised, winning by the tightest of margins, Ghana. So it can sort of, I mean, I think what tends to happen is people, you know, rather slackly pick out the ones that work. And, you know, and then ignore all the counter examples. And that's, you know, that's annoying. But I think that's often what happens.
So if I could take us specifically to my own research area and be selfish here, I'd like to ask you a little bit about Argentina since my research center is there. And it was good to see in your acknowledgments that you tipped the hat to Alabarces and Friedenberg, two people that I met and worked with this past summer in Argentina. Did you have empanadas with Friedenberg at his home? Because I did the same thing over the summer.
Did you eat a lot of empanadas?
Oh, every day, because I live. I got a place right next to a...
Man, that boy can stick away some empanadas.
Yes, he can. Pardon?
Are they both well?
They're both very well. Alavarez, this maybe ties into football's tool for political mobilization is in, you know, the disenchantment that you felt after the book, you know, after he's written so extensively on soccer, he's also turned away and is now going towards Rock Nacional. So when I sort of showed up and spun my dissertation idea at him, he said, "That's very interesting, but I'm not going to be working on soccer too much anymore, so but I'll always talk to you." Friedenberg, you'll be glad to hear, has just released an edited volume with a lot of his colleagues, all of whom I was able to play soccer with on a weekly basis. So I had a fantastic experience there.
Right.
I wanted to commend you, first of all, on your treatment of Argentine history. I imagine that if you were to talk to dozens of historians of all their respective regions, they would try and pick you apart and say, "Oh, well, you didn't exactly get this right, or the politics is a little bit more complex, or not doing it justice." But you did a phenomenal job with Argentina, and I really think that your treatment of that history has another dimension to things like import substitution, industrialization. Viewing it through the lens of football is completely different, and you see sort of the political changes going on in the country as they parallel club and national team fortunes in such a completely different way. I just want to commend you on that. Also, a couple of points in theory and method that I'm hoping to take into my own work. You talk about, you know, quantifying style, and this is something that we talked about with Bob Edelman when we talked about his book Spartak Moscow. We were talking about the Uruguayan influence on Russian soccer. And he was commenting on the difficulty of trying to quantify that style based on reports versus film and films he couldn't and could not see. And I thought early in the book you talk about sort of the problems of quantifying style and its diffusion. I thought you did a really good job of, you know, the few notes of caution that you sound there. Also, TV's influence. I think you do a phenomenal job with that in the high industrial chapter on Europe and sort of how TV is important in some ways, but doesn't really take off until you know, 70s and such. But specifically about Argentina, my own dissertation, I'm talking about the politics of ownership, something that you've identified as a very rich vein to mine. And I think in Argentina, it's a particularly rich vein to mine because you have you know, club loyalties so firmly ingrained into a very specific neighborhood, ethnic and political identities that haven't really gone away. And it didn't escape me that you're wearing a Boca Juniors T-shirt on your on the back cover here of the Centenario. So if you could maybe just shamelessly, if you could talk about my research interests, but also specifically the capacity of Argentines to mobilize themselves politically along these lines of their clubs. Is that something that you definitely found in the literature? And also
you're going to have to repeat the last question that you got to, because just broke up there for me.
So clubs as sites of political mobilization in Argentina, and also the reasons for Argentina not participating in the World Cup post-1950. Is that something you got from a very specific historian in Argentina? Just because I find that as the one very contentious issue that I found in the book about Argentina. I've met many Argentine academics who will say Argentina was excluded and Perón was deliberately excluded from international competition rather than being afraid to enter.
Okay, well, there you go. I couldn't tell you where that comes from, and that's, you know, one of the problems of doing your footnotes and your bibliography in 2 minutes at the end of the process. I honestly don't know, and I am completely open to hearing, you know, I just don't know. God, I'd have to go up into the loft of my house and get some very big boxes out and go and look. Man, I don't know. I don't know. Were Argentina excluded? I've certainly never heard the argument or read anywhere else in the English-speaking world that Argentina were being actively excluded from World Cups. That's all I can add to that, really. So,
and how about your experience with the clubs in Argentina? Did you find their history very unique, or did you find an obvious parallel elsewhere?
Okay. I mean, it struck me. Is there any parallel where clubs are quite so politicized in the same way? I mean, it wasn't all clubs. I mean, I suppose it was, you know, yeah, that's the whole network kind of takes off. No, I suppose it is unique. I can't think of anywhere else. I mean, I'm open to suggestion from others. And I think Buenos Aires is so unique because it's, you know, the National League has got 14 clubs all on a sort of pinhead next to each other in a very kind of grid-orientated city that's very sort of sharply divided in all sorts of ways, but are butting up against each other. I mean, it sort of generates an intensity about the meaning of clubs that, you know, that I think politicians have fed off and mobilized in some ways. I can't think of anywhere else that pertains. Maybe sort of Vienna in some ways, you know, when it was just tiny little red Vienna in a sea of black Catholic Austria that doesn't play football, and you've got the whole professional league happening there, and you've got Jews and Slovaks, I mean, working class, middle class. It's not quite the same, but maybe a hint of it.
Yeah, maybe Moscow too fits into that, because Bob Edelman was telling us a few months ago about Spartak, and in his book, I mean, the history of Moscow football is for many decades essentially the history of most of Soviet soccer as well. It's not until the '60s that you get the sides from, you know, Georgia and Ukraine really competing at the level of the Moscow sides, let alone clubs from the other republics. So I think there are maybe some parallels at certain times in different countries, this sort of bias towards the capital cities, perhaps. But Buenos Aires is extreme.
Can I just ask everyone, is anyone checking the Tottenham Inter score? Because I'm getting texts from my Inter.
We're 4-0 down, Dave.
Yeah,
it's absolutely disaster.
That's what I thought. I got a text from
playing
Arsenal.
A man down.
Go on, you got sit down.
My Arsenal supporting friend texted me to say, are you under sedation? Okay. 4-0. Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear.
Peter Crouch played in the season.
You should have kept Berbatov, Dave.
4-0, that's humiliating. And what, we're not even at half-time, are we? We are
35 minutes. One goal, one down after a minute. Goalkeeper sent off and a penalty after about 10. Three down after 14, and we've just gone four down now.
Maybe Harry's had a bet on us losing. He's got a spot bet on us losing. So. Oh, dear. Okay. Sorry.
Listening to this is doing wonders for my morale, because if I was just watching the game, I'd be slitting your wrists by now, so you're keeping me alive.
Tim, you had been cut off. I think you were asking a second question. Did you want another shot at it?
No, it was all right. I think the second question was going to be a flip comment about Inter Milan Tottenham, but the less said about that game, the better, so move on.
Did anyone else have a second question that they wanted to ask?
Yeah, I'll chime in again. It's Tom, and you talked about the architecture of your book and 20 months and 500,000 words. Can you talk a little about the writing process and what that looked like on a day-to-day basis?
What did it look like? It varied. I got faster. I mean, I did feel... I came back from the African Nations Cup in, I don't know, about February, March 2004, and that's when I started writing, and I wrote the first three Africa chapters in about 2 months, I suppose, and I felt like I was so at the bottom of a very, very steep cliff. It was a bit scary, actually, and then I went to Euro 2004 and did bugger all for a month other than have a really good time. So things got very serious when I got back from Euro 2004, and I got faster, and the last sort of three or four months, I was just, I mean, it was kind of really amazing sort of moment for me. I was just going sort of brain to screen every day, 3,000 words or so, almost not thinking about it, just writing. It was like, that's the closest I've come to the flow of football, is that moment. I think in terms of the architecture and sort of what made that possible at the end was that the structure of the book that I drew up, you know, right at the beginning, was, it worked. I just stayed with it, and it sort of seemed to get better and more coherent to me at any rate as I went along. And, you know, I'd read a lot of world history. You know, I'd done my time with, oh God, you know, models of capitalism and, you know, world systems theory, and I mean, I'd just been over and over that ground. And then I read Eric Hobsbawm's Age of Extremes, you know, which is a very particular take on the whole story. But nonetheless, one that, you know, just gave me another kind of sort of framework around which to think about things. So that was all, you know, very deep. You know, and I drew on a lot of stuff, like I was saying earlier. I'd been at the game for quite a long time, so it was, and I just sort of drew on that. I just drew on that. It was a jolly hard. That's the other thing, I'll say. I mean, it was just very difficult towards the end, and I was, you know, there was a lot of kind of put the kids to bed and write from 9 till 1, 9 till 2. You know. Why I got a bit depressed at the end of it. But I wouldn't change it for anything, you know, because the highs of it were intellectually and personally sort of some of the biggest highs of my life, to be able to write like that. You know, like, you get momentum, don't you? And I was just sort of runaway trained by the end of that.
Thank you.
Feel free to turn this part of the conversation into more of informal. Anyone can jump in on anything that's been said here.
The question of global history, perhaps. Aside from the fact that football is the world's game, are there certain factors that you would point to that really make this a global history? Is it the transnational institutions like FIFA? Is it mass media? Is it capital? Is it the living cults? What is it that, if you had to narrow it down, that brings these connections across the planet really together and make them alive?
I might throw urbanization into that game. I mean, that's something that I very much saw throughout the book, is that every geographic turn you make, and granted, you said that you were looking for crowds, you were looking for the collective experience, which is fundamental in creating these identities, but maybe urbanization would be another to throw into that pot.
Yeah. What makes it global? I mean, I think one of the great pleasures of writing the book was I just write a different point of global history. One in which, you know, you'll know from your own reading, Africa doesn't figure much in most of the narratives. And where it doesn't get too great a press. And so it was great to be able to write a global history that put Africa much more center stage, which told some different, I mean, also some sort of terribly familiar stories about the place as well. And, you know, in which the US, for much of the book, which of course is, you know, completely and rightly the dominant character in any 20th century history, in some way recedes and is more of a curiosity rather than the model or the leading edge, and sort of, you know, that makes more space for everybody else. And similarly, I mean, Latin America, you know, really gets a poor showing in most kind of global history. So that's in terms of that's the sort of global history that I wanted to write. What makes it global? Oh, I think it's the things, you know, that you've said, Peter. I mean, in terms of collective televisual mass media experiences, it's pretty hard to top. And of course, you know, the story of the emergence of mass media within nations is also, you know, told by football, because so often the coverage of live sport is the kind of leading edge, you know, of technological and commercial development. I mean, Rupert Murdoch, you know, knew what he was talking about when he called live sport the battering ram of satellite tech, and it's always been that way. So I think it sort of locks us into that. I think it's just sort of global history in the sense that, you know, there are things that have happened over the last 100 years, you know, I suppose as a sociologist that you look at, like processes of urbanization, the emergence, you know, of industrialization and so on, which